that I said, I can't compete anymore. Sorry, clients. I've lost the ability to do this well. I need to go somewhere else. It's clear that this is something different that I need to pursue, need some different answers.
Why do you think I've avoided that word for a long time?
Well, geez, hasn't it become just a little tainted almost, right? From what we might have originally thought, or maybe tainted's not the right word, but
no,
it, yeah,
I think
it's pretty twisted, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't, I don't think that word means what you think it means.
No.
Why am I using these tools? Why would I? Why wouldn't I? What are the horses really interested in? Why am I asking them anything at all? I step back from riding, really. So what's, if this is just for me, if this is just to build my ego, why am I putting myself onto these horses?
Welcome to Horse First with Lockie Phillips, a podcast about paying closer attention to the horse, to the work that we do with horses, and paying attention to what's actually happening in front of us. Not what looks good, not what we've been told looks good, because sometimes we slow down and sometimes we speed up, but we don't pretend. I'm Lockie Phillips. Let's begin. Today I'm joined by Michelle Knapp. Michelle is one of my most senior and trusted colleagues and someone who's been doing the work quietly and consistently at a very high level for a long time. Michelle is now stepping forward to deliver clinics under the Emotional Horsemanship banner, bringing her own depth, precision, and clarity into that space. This conversation's about refinement and the ways that dressage has become a bit of a tainted word, and why, and how we might take our horsemanship to higher levels without slipping back into lower quality practices. Michelle, welcome back. Hello, Michelle Knapp. How are you doing?
Hello, Lockie Phillips. I'm doing great. So excited to be here for our third podcast.
Third podcast, but who's counting? And there'll be more and more and more going forwards. Like, what's the friendship version of nepotism? Right? It's like the people I want to work with and podcast with are like, maybe not my family, no hate to my family, but like my friends and the people I enjoy spending time with, that's who I want to podcast with. So whatever the friendship version of nepotism is, that's kind of what we're doing here.
I'm okay with that. I'm really okay with that.
Yeah, I have no qualms about it either. So we've got a lot of ground to cover today. Agreed?
Yep. Yes.
So this is what, year number three going into teaching team year three for you?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah.
It is.
We met almost 3 years ago at that clinic in Michigan. That was almost 3 years ago. Can you believe it?
Yeah,
next month, it'll be 3 years ago.
Oh, it's our three-iversary.
Three-iversary.
Yeah. So, it's been a jam-packed 3 years.
Jam-packed 3 years. A lot has changed. Our team is changing also. We've entered in a new chapter and a new era in our work. And therefore, we are galvanized, focused, and totally committed to our community and to our work. So, shall we get into it?
Let's do. And just to say how excited I am also to see the evolution of this team, because this is something that I'm just really committed to long term, to being able to help anchor and grow the emotional horsemanship team in a way that is sustainable and beneficial for so many horses and horse people. So it's really exciting to see what Lori is bringing and where we're
and all. And Haley, as she goes into her first full year with us. But Lori and Haley, yes, a totally different energy. And I'm so excited, even though emotional horsemanship was like, let's say, my creation initially, the soonest possible opportunity I got to distribute the teaching responsibilities to others that were in alignment with me, I did. The soonest possible opportunity I got to work in a team, a small team, I did. The soonest possible opportunity, and this is the most important point, soonest possible opportunity I got to remove myself from the center spotlight of my own work? I did. And that's very difficult to do without losing momentum, without losing business, without losing clients. I did lose some clients in that process. Some of my clients did not want to play in a team. They wanted Lockie and only Lockie, and they were upset and felt abandoned when I introduced the notion of working with a team. And that's fine. It's horses for courses. But in order to grow a movement around horses and prevent guruism, my responsibility is to remove myself from the center as frequently as possible, as often as possible, without abdicating leadership responsibilities. So that's what I'm very excited about, is walking the talk on that very important point, so that we're creating safe places for our community and our students to land and learn.
Yes. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing that you have the flexibility and structure within yourself to be able to dance on that line, because that's that takes a lot of, that's tricky. And you do it with grace.
I think I do it. You say grace, I say by the skin of my teeth with you say grace, I say a little bit of desperation, a little bit of flying by the seat of my pants, but we make it happen. Mm-hmm. And anyway, for those who don't know you, give us an opportunity to understand your path in horsemanship, because you got chops, Miss Lady, Miss Michelle, Mrs. Michelle Knapp. You have some serious chops in this field. Well,
I mean, thank you. But yeah, a little brief.
You just got so uncomfortable, like Midwesterner on me. I know you're from Arizona originally, but you've been in Wisconsin long enough. You just got so buttoned up tight, like, oh, he's complimenting me. Shit, in public.
Well, you know, it's weird when you think back. You're asking me, think back about your horsemanship beginnings. And also, wow, you've got a lot of chops. Okay, so I'm going back in my mind to little baby me looking and going, oh, horses. And then trying to...
In the beginning, there was light, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Extrapolating to now nearly 50-year-old me and going, yeah, it's okay. I earned these gray hairs. That's true. Mm. Okay. Mm. So, it's feeling the difference in those two places and in how excited I was as a little kid. Like, I didn't come from a horsey family. I brought horses into my family, being so passionate about them.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's the story we've heard over and over again, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, it's not surprising. So, you know, at 12 years old, I was calling around in Southern Arizona to the Arabian barns because that's what was there. And
still, even to this day.
Probably somewhat, but less, you know, that market kind of tanked a little bit. But I was calling around to these barns and saying, do you have opportunities for me, you know, at 12 to come out and work, and found one and ended up being into the Arabian show world at a young age because that's what was locally available. And so my first horse at, I think, 13 years old was a 4-year-old Arabian mare. Mm-hmm. And what an introduction that was. She was fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I was inundated in the Arabian show world for several years. And migrated over to dressage in the Arabian sphere in like the late 1990s, early 2000s, because I was looking for something that was a little more partnership based, right? When you've got breed shows, that's very form over function, let's say. You take the horse, you put it into a frame, you go around in the arena. Yeah. That's pretty much what every discipline in a breed show looks like. And when I was looking at dressage in the 1990s, I was looking at a lot of magazines, right? There was no internet back then. Let me put on my grandma hat. Like, the internet. We didn't have videos of dressage. You know, I was looking at magazines and books. And my experience of dressage then basically came from like the 1970s and 1960s, some of the 1980s. And then a little bit of videos in the 1990s. But I had my exposure to dressage was some people didn't even have saddle pads. You know, these pictures that we're looking at of, of these horses. So it was a good contrast to what I was experiencing in the Arabian show world, where they had shaved ears and shaved nostrils. And, you know, we put highlighting goo on their faces to make them look more makeuped, I guess.
Goldfish-like?
Yeah.
They make them look like those goggle-eyed goldfish. You know?
You're not wrong. It's pretty funny. Right. So what drew me into dressage was that it looked like we had an opportunity for systematic progression and development for the horse. And this partnership, that it wasn't just the human putting their costume on the horse and putting them into a neat little package and parading them around in a circle. And don't get me wrong, like 15-year-old me was really enjoying parading them around in a circle because it was horses. Like, it was fantastic. But I knew there was more. There was more in that partnership aspect. So that's what drew me into dressage. And played around with that in the Arabian sphere for a handful of years, and then moved out, branched out into the open dressage world, and became just fascinated with that and dived into dressage in my local area and worked in the clubs, and then got into judging and went into the organizing and participating in the USDF, the United States Dressage Federation's L program for judge training. So that's like a rigorous, you have to qualify for acceptance into the program by having enough scores at this point. Again, this was 25 years ago, I think now. You had to have enough scores competing yourself up through second level to get accepted into the program. Basically, that was one of the paths there. And then it's a year-long program where you have different sessions, weekend-long sessions, where you're learning all about judging, biomechanics, standards, practices, and you have to also have 20 hours of sitting with dressage judges and 25 hours of scribing with dressage judges throughout that year. So you're traveling all over. Just the amount of time you're spending at dressage shows is a lot. And then you get to practice judge some and be scored on your scoring of the dressage show. So that's kind of a fun inception tornado. But a really helpful process to go through, because it causes you to need to prioritize what you're seeing, be able to describe it, and think about a bunch of tiny details and what those tiny details have to do with the overall picture that you're looking for. So being able to score each movement, but still keep the collective marks in your brain the whole time. And then you've got about 30 seconds before the next person's coming in. I think that was a really helpful aspect for me in teacher training, right? Because if you can do that under pressure, having someone come in front of you with whatever myriad of issues they might be wanting help with, my brain's getting trained to keep an overall picture in mind of what we're looking for, but be able to zoom in and zoom out on some of those details while still hopefully holding the larger picture in place.
So from the Arabian show world into dressage training, dressage competing, and then dressage judging, what was the next step for you after that? Because I'm assuming you didn't stop at dressage.
That is a correct assumption. Yes. I ended up with this amazing warm blood gelding. So I had been training mostly non-traditional breeds, Arabians, ponies, quarter horses, Morgans, whatever people kind of had. And then I had this opportunity to find this amazing Selle-Français cross gelding. He was 17-2. He had just unbelievable gaits. But emotionally, he was in a lot of trouble and I didn't know how to help him. And being able to campaign him a little bit and come up against this wall again and again, like, wow, the great tools that I've learned in dressage are not fully addressing the areas in his emotional development that are lacking or in mine. And that is what opened the door for me to see natural horsemanship as an alternative. So at the time in the early 2000s, in Southern Arizona, there was a little bit of a Pirelli presence. And the big push there was relationship-based. Are you having problems with your horse communicating with them clearly or with the relationship between the two of you? And hey, have you thought of groundwork? It's this whole thing you can do. So that's where I diverted from dressage over to natural horsemanship. Because again, we've got a systematic development, a progression that we can go through of the levels. They identified a problem that I was having with clear communication and developing my relationship with my horse. And the introduction of groundwork as a concept. So that really wasn't something I had even been introduced to before that period. So there was where I diverged in the woods, that path. Mm.
And how long were you in the Pirelli world and how far did you get in the Pirelli world?
Mm-hmm. So probably, let's see, that was 2003 that I said, I can't compete anymore. Sorry, clients. I've lost the ability to do this well. I need to go somewhere else. It's clear that this is something different that I need to pursue, need some different answers. And I was a hardcore student from probably 2005 to 2009. And then I became an instructor in the Pirelli organization from about 2009 to 2016. And I became a 3-star instructor for Pirelli, which basically meant I could teach clinics. I could teach all of the different savvies and levels. I could lead courses at the campuses. I could be, you know, on tour with them, going around demonstrating things. So it was sort of that's the first ranking in that system where you were kind of fully accredited, so to speak.
You got a seat to the round table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we discussed it last year on the podcast in great depth, what it was like to be in that organization and why you stepped away from it. So any listener who's wanting to understand a little bit more why you stepped away from that, I refer them to last year's conversation where we went into more depth with that. So let's not waste too much time there.
Perfect.
However, in a nutshell, if you could just give people in a nutshell what happened next for you.
Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest draws to begin with for me into Pirelli was, again, the horse needing the communication part, but also it was clear there was community. Mm. It was a big community-driven, relationship-driven organization. Mm-hmm. And when it became clear that there was a point that the evolution of my horsemanship awareness and education was branching off from the direction that the main organization was going in, when that divergence really felt strong enough, and I thought, the benefit of being attached to this community is now outweighed by the cons of the direction that the organization is going in, horsemanship, client relation-wise, all of that. I decided that it was the appropriate time to go off on my own, even though I didn't have the backing of community or the support of, you know, that community.
The support of an 8-figure organization.
Yeah. Know. Yeah. Right. Right. Mm. And just saying the horses were saying, this is not the next evolution. Like there had been a leap and we're no longer following that path. Like, why are you? Mm. Why don't you come and hang out in the pasture and put some of these questions to us? Like, just so that was what really pulled me. As I went, my sponge is full with all of this. Here's what you do. Here's why you do it. Here's when you do it. Just do it. Just do it. Just do it. That sponge just got full for me and there was no more coming in. I said, well, if I'm not here taking in anything else, where am I being pulled? And it was out into the pasture. It was really, I was feeling my horses say, what's all this doing? What's behind it? What's it for? Have you even sat here and seen what we're about?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what pulled me into the next evolution, into Underneath My Rock, which is where you found me. So reference podcast episode 1.
Mm.
That's where I was. I was just sitting. Yeah, sitting there, still doing my thing, but really trying to explore, why am I using these tools? Why would I? Why wouldn't I? What are the horses really interested in? Mm. Why am I asking them anything at all? I step back from riding, really. I said, what's, if this is just for me, if this is just to build my ego, why am I putting myself onto these horses?
Yeah. And that's where we found each other at a clinic. And from the first time I met you at a clinic, when I needed an extra pair of hands, your hand went up in the air and I was like, yep, this makes sense. So I think of you as my work wife, in the sense that we're kind of wedded to each other in that way through work. And dear listener, I know that some listeners might be cluey enough to hear the pattern in Michelle's story of going through an evolution, finding the problems with it, moving on to the next, finding the problems with it, moving on to the next, finding the problems with it, moving on to the next. I'd like to maybe be confident enough to say that I feel like Michelle is home here with us in this team, and that we are, I am, you are creating something together that has sustainable presence over the long term and space for evolution without having to leave it. If that makes sense, because that's how I roll. I want to be able to evolve without having to abandon. I want to learn without incinerating and erasing my past. I want to integrate the things from a certain era of my life into the next era of my life and my organization, our teaching team, our focus on horsemanship reflects that. And also, I'm speaking around something. Allow me to speak directly. When Michelle joined the team, I basically said to you, Michelle, I said, you watched Pirelli go down in flames. I need you, having been someone who was there, who knows the patterns and the red flags, to walk with me and point them out to me if I accidentally or on purpose engage with them also. Because I don't want to make those mistakes. As I grow a teaching team, as I take up a little bit of space, the tiniest, tiniest wafer thin slice of the pie that Pirelli got, I'm getting. The waferest of wafers I'm getting. But still, the patterns are there. And there are many people out there who are so concerned about Lockie Phillips growing a teaching team, Lockie Phillips starting an MLM in horsemanship. I need them to know that those concerns are really well placed. But I'm building a team that's got accountability built in, and you're my accountability touchstone. I said, Michelle, if I ever make that mistake, I need you to tell me and tell me straight away and say a little to the left, a little to the right. And so far, we haven't really had to have that conversation yet. We came close a couple of times, but I think I course corrected before you ever had to say anything. Would that be accurate?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, we've certainly touched on that because I mean, the thing is, this is meant to be, as you've talked about before, like horsemanship is meant to be supported by a community. It's only sustainable, really, for us as professionals, for us as professionals, when we have those touchstones of peers as well. And that's one of the things that we've been missing from so many horsemanship professionals' lives. So I think this is something where, like you mentioned with guru culture, it touches that nerve for people when we start to note that you have a method or something that you've created and speak directly to the fact that you are decentralizing yourself from that. That's a sticky spot because it highlights for people that it exists in the first place. And if they felt like maybe they participated in that, right? That
hot button topic.
A bit of a hot button topic.
Because what's the motivation? What's the intent? And what's the impact of building a team, of systemizing your approach to training, of being able to build an approach to horses that can live and breathe outside of an individual's body, but can go and breathe into another? allow me to wax lyrical on that for about 3 minutes, set the clock. Number one, if my approach to horsemanship can go outside of myself into another teacher's body without that teacher losing their own identity, then there's 100% chance that that's going to succeed for a student also.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's that. Two, just because we're organized around our approach to horses does not mean I am attempting, in a patriarchal sense, to create a monument to my ego out of this operation. Far from it. My end game out of all of this is that I evaporate from a public presence altogether as soon as possible. Please, God, can I do it tomorrow? That's my end game. My end game is that I can evaporate from a public presence, return myself to myself, no longer be in public eye, but have built something that lives and breathes without me being in the driver's seat, that is successful, that is secure, that is sustainable, so that as many people as possible who need or want to integrate with the organization, to benefit from it, to do better with their horses, to be safer, to be more successful, to find more joy in their passion and their hobby, then I will organize. The presence of organization is not the presence of a cult.
Right, exactly.
And the presence of disorganization is not the absence of a cult,
yes,
by the way. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of performative anti-marketing going on in the industry right now. Oh, I'm disorganized. I haven't got my shit together. I don't have a method, and therefore you can trust me. What?
Mm-hmm.
What?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I had someone on my Instagram recently say, because I was talking in my car, and they said, I cannot believe as a horse person your car's that clean. Having said that, I did get in my car last night at 10:30 p.m. with a handheld vacuum cleaner and detail that mother top to bottom. Mm-hmm. You can be a horse person and still want to have a clean car. You can be a horse trainer and still want to have a clean and clear organization. These things are not mutually exclusive. So the benefits of building a teaching team is also I get to see other people benefit from my work, not just myself. Other mm-hmm. professionals benefit from my work, not just myself. And I get to like be the least interesting or important person in the room, which is the antidote to a patriarchal society. We don't need more rooms filled mostly with paying female clients where the man is the most interesting person in the room. We don't need more of that. I will mm-hmm. weaponize that for a short period of time so that I can give something back from that, you know, pay it forward in a sense. Anyway, that's my 3 minutes. I'm going to step off that. But do you have any?
It's important. I mean, that's such an important thing to speak to. And even just rewinding a moment back to the whole marketing thing where, I mean, that was something we heard in Pirelli all the time. Because that was one of the things they were very good at. And there's a whole anti-marketing. I get it. Nobody wants to be sold to. Nobody wants to be scammed. But also,
but just because you're being sold doesn't mean you're being scammed.
Exactly. That's not, but how do we survive? How do we go on sustainably in business as professionals without letting people know who we are and what we do and why we do it?
Right.
So there's a big difference between, oh, here's my latest t-shirt line every year, and here's my video content displaying what I'm doing. And I shouldn't even just say that that's not, it's just an example. It's not necessarily.
Well, all businesses have a product to sell. That's kind of like the first rule of business. What are you selling? And I'm sorry, this is not a hobby for us. This is our livelihood. This is how we make a living, and you know, we're not doing this for free. This is a paid pursuit for us, and we would do it for free if we could, but as far as I know, we're still in a capitalistic society and we require money to pay our bills. So
absolutely,
I think the performative anti-marketing movement from some of my colleagues is the ultimate transgression in terms of toxic competitiveness towards the people to their left and their right. They're trying to intimidate and shut up their competitors so their competitors feel shamed for marketing their work, so that their competitors aren't marketing their work, so that they get the lion's share. It's like the ultimate reversal, like reverse psychology. They are actually marketing themselves when they talk about the problems of marketing. You're actually marketing yourself. You're tapping into people's insecurities and fears around being burned by the Pirelli organization, by being scammed by other trainers. You're tapping into people's insecurities about that. And now you're weaponizing those insecurities against your colleagues and making them feel ashamed for advertising themselves so that they can put bread on their table. No horse person, very few horse people get out of this extremely wealthy.
Right? No, this is not a wealth building exercise.
No, really. I looked at my horse's supplement protocol lately and I said, boys, I'm thrilled for your health, but my God, please God, we've got to find an alternative to some of these supplements we're using. And I have. But anyway, that was a little bit tangential, but I think really important to touch on, because a lot of people are skeptical around me saying this is my team. And I want people to know who's saying that. When we say this is my team, who's saying that and why we're saying that and from where that's coming from. It's a totally different place, right?
Yeah, and if you want, like you mentioned about having the information be sustainable, if you're really interested in it handing down generation to generation, you can't gatekeep it in one person's voice. It can't survive in one person's voice. It has to branch out.
Speaking of,
being carried forward in multiple other voices. That's just the
and
path.
Bodies and brains.
But you know, that's the path to sustainability. Yeah. It's not just holding so tightly to parroted language that's exact and specific. And I think this is an important point.
Yeah. Like speaking on that, you are now going to go teach an emotional horsemanship clinic by Michelle Knapp at a place with my friend Claire Aiken, who has hosted me twice for a clinic at that location. And now you're going back to a place that I frequented. This will be the third appearance of my work, our work there. And now you're representing it. I will not be there. I have not given you a PDF that says, Michelle, this is what you must teach and this is how you have to teach it. I have not done that. Have I asked you one time for detailed prospectus about the techniques you're going to teach them and how you're going to teach them and in what order?
No, you have not.
Right. No. Have I brought you to clinics, had you at clinics and said, watch what I'm about to do because it could be a suggestion of a framework for you going forwards that I could hand over to you? Have I done that?
Indeed, you have.
I have done that. Have I ever gotten on your neck or on your back hammering on you about integrity or about a detail about something that you said that I didn't like or that was not in alignment with the vision or the message? Have I ever done that?
No, that is not.
Have I spent a lot of time and energy encouraging you to open your voice box and be creative with the work that we're exploring together?
Only like every single day.
Right. So like there was a conversation because we have a group chat, you, me, Haley, and now Laurie. We have a group chat and Haley and Catherine too, administrator. And Haley was asking, Lockie, when I'm talking about my training, can I use the terminology that you've coined? I was like, oh, sorry, you needed my permission to do that? Yes, of course you can. And by the way, if you've got a different word to teach the same thing, please do. My friend Laurie calls metaphor bonding little spoon, right? And so you can come up with your own language to teach the same framework. Not a problem for me at all. Because that's like, gives me the ick if I was like, you have to use these terms and you have to put the trademark after every time you say emotion. No. Mm-hmm. Gross.
Mm-hmm.
No, thank you.
It's an important line. It's an important distinction to make there, because language can free us or it can trap us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say we should be imprecise with our language.
Or unclear.
No, it's to say there's room for flexibility and personal interpretation, which actually is what can empower students to take it on themselves and experiment.
That's right. And if I'm not asking my our team, my teachers, to do that, themselves, how can you guys do that for a student?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because this is not a chicken nugget factory.
Oh, good. I mean, I'm glad. You know,
we're dealing with living people, living horses, and so that the methodology should be alive and adaptable and fluid without being unclear.
Uh-huh.
So circling back to the dressage thing, let me just say this a few times. Dressage, 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 dressage. Yeah. Dressage. If I say it enough times, the algorithm's going to pick the podcast up and put it in front of a dressage person. Now, I've avoided that word for a long time. I'm going to let you put word in my mouth. Why do you think I've avoided that word for a long time?
Well, geez, hasn't it become just a little tainted almost, right? From what we might have originally thought, or... maybe tainted's not the right word, but
no,
yeah,
I think
it's pretty tested, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think that word means what you think it means.
No.
We have a little
not everywhere, not to paint everyone with the same brush, not everywhere, and not every interpretation of dressage. There are beautiful examples out in the field of people who use the word dressage and do beautiful work. But when we say the word dressage, usually what's people's first image, the zeitgeist, the first image that comes up? Michelle, what would be the first image that comes up now?
I think it would be an Olympic competitor.
Right. And so what are we seeing at that level?
We're seeing, if I snapshot it in my mind, we're seeing a double bridle, a short neck, tightness, fancy clothes, sweat, and probably...
foaming mouth.
That's just where I was going. Yes, with it, you could
flashy leg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Flashy leg action.
Yep. And if we go back to where I was saying where I started in the Arabian world, this is a spot where I feel like we're looking more at form now in that snapshot.
Hmm.
We're looking at flash and costume. There are sparkles on all sorts of things now. I'm not anti-sparkle, but we have Swarovski crystals on whips and spurs and gloves.
Yeah, in the absence of the deeper aspects of the work, which are more valuable and important to the horse. And this is what my friend Alexa Linton was saying on the podcast. She was crying out for us to all go deeper. Mm-hmm. We've got to step back from shallowness. We've got to go deeper. It's a big mistake when the work becomes shallow. Not a problem to have a sparkly something. Go for it. Love that. I frequently compliment people who come to clinics with sparkly something, and I love them for it. I think that's just fun and harmless. But if you're doing that in the absence of read between the lines, then that's a problem. And I think dressage has become a little tainted because of what we're seeing. And many horse people like yourself, like myself, for whom... the idea of dressage would be a natural fit, have stepped away from it because it is tainted. Listen, I am tall, long-legged, former classically trained ballet dancer who got into horses while I was living in Europe. It would have been a natural step.
Perfect fit.
To just get the patent leather high boots, get myself a nice double bridle and a nice big brown horse and play ball with everyone else. That would have been a natural stepping stone only if someone is judging me at a shallow level by optics, by aesthetics, and by a checklist. If they're judging me and my journey on that shallow checklist only, dressage would have been a natural stepping stone. And indeed, I had many opportunities to step into it, into dressage as we know it, competitive dressage as we know it. Many opportunities were presented to me where all I had to do was reach out and the opportunities would have been right there in front of me, natural progression. And yet I'd made discerning efforts to step away from it and go in a different direction because of what you said, it's tainted.
Well, and I want to just clarify that sparkle thing. Because where it comes from for me is not, as I mentioned, it's not anti-bedazzling things. No, But when I grew up with it, I mean, you might know I have a slightly utilitarian aesthetic. You've met me.
Yes.
But also, I'm a slight rule book follower and reader. Like, I read the manuals. I read the rule books. I feel like the dressage rule book was like poetry. Mm. It was so clear and even flowery in its language. And when I was going through my judging school, one of the things that would describe the attire was that it should never detract from the brilliance of the horse.
Nice so idea.
The reason that we didn't have contrasting color coats or loud colors, and it was like boring navy or black, white. That's it. That was all that was going on in early 2000s. And yes, that's boring and there's not room for individuality. Like, I get that. But why? Why was it important? Because what was supposed to show was the brilliance of the horse and the horse's performance. So that's why I kind of pull on that detail, because not because I don't like, I mean, again, I came from the Arabian world. I showed an Arabian native costume at one point. Okay, so that's like, you are head to toe sequined.
Done. Drag. It's drag. It's drag. It's drag, baby.
You fly into the arena and you're carrying and hand galloping. And it's like this thing. So I'm not against.
Yeah.
But that was the purpose. The purpose was to show the costume.
Right.
And so it's that, I just note that because it was a transition. It was sort of this spot that signaled something has changed in the industry when we've gone from, let's hold this line, to a little slippery slope. So I just wanted to note that, because I think it's more than just attire level. It's a deeper level. It signifies
a deeper level. It's alluding to the Alice in Wonderland of it all. You just got a little bit sidetracked and you followed the white rabbit, and then very quickly you're off in Wonderland and you forget where you actually came from. And so it's a little bit like what's happening, but I want to like see people like us, you, me, take up a little space on the subject of dressage, because what was I doing last night at sunset? Dressage.
Yeah.
By my definition of it, no one else's, my definition of it. So how can we, as teachers, translate classical ideas for horse people and riders who may not come from dressage backgrounds and or who feel a bad taste in their mouth when you say the word dressage?
I love it. I love it because this is one of my favorite aspects of what we do, of horsemanship in general. Is for me, I kind of first need to define what dressage means for me in an everyday perspective, right? And where I go with that is the idea of it just being good, basic training that helps the horse develop and become more self-empowered, become more more athletic, and that we can set up this framework for them where when we're together, they're seeking balance and we're seeking balance, and that there's some precision involved. This is one of the cool things about dressage that I love, is that it does hold us to a standard of a sequential progression of precision. Like when you start out at the lower levels, hey, can you do a transition kind of roughly between these two points? Give you a whole long side. Can you just kind of make it happen somewhere in there? And then as you progress up the levels through time and education, we need that transition to happen here at this specific point. So it gives us this place to go in this arc. But some of those most important points that I carry through are about helping the horse develop postural autonomy and the human to develop spatial awareness and positional integrity. And you can have those things interacting when you're leading. When you're around going from point A to point B or through a gate, how do you bring more elements into, you know, gate hygiene?
Literally just saw a post today on my Facebook about someone who got, someone of a certain age getting knocked down at a gate, compound fracture in their leg. And this is causing, and it's happening all the time, and it's causing a slide back into dominance modalities as people feel like they're casualties of the Horse First movement because they're trying to be gentle, but what they're doing when they're being gentle is abandoning everything they've ever learned about horses ever and have become exceedingly unclear to the horses in their presence. And that's not what the Horse First movement's really about. Not at all.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Right. I feel like we're in a whole period where we're kind of coming back full circle into feeling where we went, I'm feeling feelings. I don't know how to set boundaries. I'm not able to ask anything of the horse. I don't feel worthy to make a request. Wait a second. We're getting run over. We're not being clear. The horses are floundering because they don't know where we are. We've left the building. We've left our own building.
And we address it in our work with our students. Oh my God, we are addressing it. Oh my God. Every day. Every day. I mean, we are in constant communication with our clients. All day, every day. Sometimes I'm getting text messages at midnight and I have to choose not to respond because I'm about to go to sleep. It's like, we are engaged with this issue. We are committed to this issue and we are very clear. This is not an invitation to slide back into the dark old days.
Right. Right.
Right. All transitions come with problems and we are navigating these problems and progressing with integration of past wisdom, integrating past wisdom into future possibilities. That's where we're moving into it, in a practical sense, right?
Yeah. And so when we're playing with that, and when we've got clients that we're talking about basic leading with, and we're having them bring awareness to themselves when they stop next to the horse and ask the horse to have awareness, the dimensions of its own vehicle, of their own vehicle. Can you look for balance when you're stopping? That's the way that we bring some of the beauty of dressage training into the everyday.
So, okay, let's say emotional horsemanship lives on the side of the fence of relationship-based training. I don't understand if there's any kind of relation, any kind of training with a horse that isn't relationship with the horse. Like, you have to be in relationship with the horse in order to train the horse, period. But you know what I mean? Like, the people who prioritize the way the horse feels about them, let's say that's relationship-based training. One of the problems with taking a relationship forward approach to a horse is that other things get put lower on the priority list. Other things which are pretty high on the priority list for, I would say, most horse people and most riders. And one of those things is refinement. Refinement to responses, refinement to aids, refinement to reinforcement. Refinement to their performance, refinement to their relationship to others. Refinement gets a little lost as people do the very important, valuable, and yet also messy at times work of navigating how the horse really feels about the work, their life, and them. That's messy.
Yeah. Yep.
And that takes a lot of human energy, a lot of resources, and it takes a lot of time in the training to focus on that. And as that starts to sit center stage, these things like refinement get edged out. I'm here to bring as many of our students who wish back across the border of refinement without regressing as they refine. And this is one of the problems because even someone who doesn't train like us, they'll often start really nice with a horse. And then as the horse gains in skill and they get more and more refined, the methods pursued are often lower quality practices with more leverage, more pressure, less choice for the horse. I know what I'm speaking of because I used to work with someone who used to produce beautiful, beautiful horses and had done for about 40 years. Produced thousands all over the world, by the way. It's an international person. I used to work for them, used to study with them. They said to me, for the first 2 years of the training, I'm the nice guy. And then there comes a moment in that horse's life when I get serious with them. I said, what do you mean get serious with them? He says, I get serious with them. And that's when I saw him get serious with the horse and I had to leave that job because I couldn't unsee what I had seen.
Yeah.
And it's like, because they said, well, that horse's basics are done. It's now time for refinement and refinement, serious work. So it's like, you pull the mask off, wolf in sheep's clothing. Now I'm actually not going to give you an opportunity. Now I'm going to hold you to the knife. Like, this is what's going to happen now. You are going to do these things the way I say them, as I say them, when I say them, right? And people get on the horse's throat as they get through a refinement process. How can we bring our relationship-focused training people into refinement without the danger of having them reach for stronger tools in order to stay refined?
You know, I think we need to pull apart. We conflate reactivity or prompt responses with
refinement.
Right? Like, there's urgency culture that's woven into that. Right? And so as we're teasing apart our concepts of refinement, precision, and advanced maneuvers, we need to pull them apart from, separate from immediate response, quick response, tense response. We need to take urgency culture out of our understanding.
So what is refinement? So what is refinement if it's not an immediate response?
It can be deeper. It doesn't have to be quicker.
What does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, for me, when I'm watching, when I'm looking at the progression arc of a student, say, because I'm fortunate enough now to be able to have some mentorship students that I'm working with regularly via your lovely container that you created in Emotional Horsemanship for the mentorships. So I have some students that I'm getting to watch them over the arc of 18 months, 2 years, and we're working together steadily. And I can see that refinement lives sometimes in their ability to decision make on the fly. I consider that a refined skill, to have a robust toolbox that when they encounter a challenge, they try something again, or they know this might be an opportunity for me to hold this shape longer for this horse. I consider that refinement. But outside of the realm of this is refined because it happened immediately, that's surface to me of refinement.
That's shallow. Allow me to hazard an answer at this, at my own question, and I'm certainly going to butcher it and not be clear, but let me try. Refinement, I've noticed, if I think of very practical student examples from recent history, I'm speaking lessons I've taught within the last month, that are recorded, by the way, because I am recording like 80, 90% of my body of work this year. Everything I do in the field is being recorded this year. Almost all of it. The 20% is like literally tech problems that cause me not to record it. A student of mine was working on a horse that had a very specific problem. The problem was they had some hock fusion on a right side. And once hocks are fused, they're less painful. It's when they're fusing that they're painful. So not contraindicated for work. This horse, in fact, needed the gentle weight-carrying work of riding in order to remain sound, a little bit like going to the gym and continue lifting weights as you age. And this person who is on their back is a lifelong horse person, could be teaching alongside of us, is a teacher themselves. So they're a professional horse person. So this is someone of an extremely, extremely high level. And I'm working with them. And this horse had some problems on the right hock. And what it translated to was that every time they bent to the right hock stiffness got in the way of the horse's loins. They couldn't drop the hip. And it infiltrated into the rider's seat, lifting their inside sit bone higher than the correct position it should be. As they're bending to the right, the inside sit bone I was teaching in this case should drop a little bit to give some axial rotation to the rib cage and the spine. So instead of the inside sit bone dropping a little bit, I advise them to allow this horse to hold that inside sit bone a little higher. And in fact, I want you to shift your weight forward and up off the right sit bone when you bend to the right, to not excessively pressure kidneys and loins, because the hock doesn't have space to allow that. Now, the first session, and this session's recorded, it took a lot of focus, a lot of human energy for us to get that coordinated, and it wasn't refined. We were really trying to work on it. It was hit and miss, wasn't refined. There was sometimes the horse trying it straight away with no sharpness. They would just straight away dive into the aid that we had offered. And sometimes they'd hesitate and consider the aid, delay, 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 then try. And so there was lots of variation in the horse's try, which I see as normal and healthy. It means the horse was actually problem solving. Great. 2 weeks later, they dropped on for a lesson. They had been practicing. And this little detail we had been working on, fully integrated, didn't have to talk about it because I didn't have to correct it because they had already integrated the correction to the point that the student, the rider, didn't have to think about it. It was already corrected. The horse didn't have to think about it because the problem was solved. And they would just, every time they bent to the right, the facilitation of the space for them to bend was there. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to speak on it because they had got it. For me, that's refinement. So it's not about, did they do the thing? It's like, do you even notice if the thing's there anymore? It's like, how do you know you've got a good internet connection? When you'd forget that there's an internet connection, that's when you know you've got a good internet connection, right?
Yep.
You know you've got a shit internet connection when you're thinking about the damn internet connection because it's not bloody working. Good internet connection should be there working. You don't even have to question it. Well integrated and refined skills are in the body. You don't even have to think about them anymore. They take up no more real estate in your cognitive processing or in your practice. And what it did in our session was give us an open horizon to work on something new. So we started working on some problems with impulsion rather than posture. We started working on that because they said, oh, we took them out the other day and there were some problems with impulsion. I said, well, let's work on that. So then we were able to move on to another thing with this detail around the hock, helping the hock out, fully integrated into everything they were doing. Now, if we ever encountered another problem that had a feedback loop into the original hock issue, it would challenge the hock issue to come back as a problem because the hock would be connected to another problem we're working on. So let's say like we encountered something on the left fore that was connected to the right hind. Now the hock issue resurfaced. Well, even in that instance, you would go back to say, oh, you remember that time we kind of fixed that hock issue? Let's do that thing again, focus on that correction again. But now we're going to integrate it with this other connection that we're doing as well in the front left, if that makes sense. And so these things, they could come out of the woodwork again, but they never come out of the woodwork in exactly the same way. They always come out more consolidated and more connected. Was that a butcher of an answer or did I kind of serve? I think I served that answer, if I can say that.
I think we're good.
Yeah, that's what refinement is for me without regression. And at no point did we ever think to each other, oh, let's put some spur on that.
Right.
At no point did we think, I think we need a stick. No point, at no point whatsoever. It wouldn't even occur to us. Ask, tell, demand. Didn't even cross our mind.
Sure. Yep. Antiquated. Mm-hmm. Because it's operating from that position of the horse will try when there is an opportunity. The horse wants to engage. The horse feels like if they are considered,
okay,
they want their consideration back.
What about when they don't? As Lizzo says in her song, Am I Ready? I did the work, it didn't work. There are so many people who feel that way. Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, I'm going to go do the work. What about the people who believe, really believe, because the facts of their practical situation lead them to believe that mm-hmm. their horse doesn't want to try, doesn't have a relationship to effort, isn't interested in receiving their guidance or feedback? What about the people whose reality feels that way? I say it feels that way because you and I both believe that that's not what's really happening. Something else is happening, but it feels so much like the reality for these people.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the really zoomed out view that I'm speaking of the horse collective in general. Mm. You know, the way zoomed out view of if we're either coming at it from the perspective that we can't allow the horse to have any say because once that box is open, it's done. We'll never have influence again.
Right.
That presupposes us into a whole other mess of options that we'll reach for. But yes, there are absolutely, we are encountering people that are experiencing that.
Mm-hmm.
and it is their reality.
So what do we do?
That their horse is not matching their intended, their expectation, right? I think this has a lot to do with expectations and parsing out, where does your expectation live? What's it based on? And then looking at that person's horse's history. Like, what do we do? Well, we go to what is their daily life? What is their environment? All roads lead to horse keeping. We go back. Does that horse have its basic needs met? And is it properly resourced to meet the needs of the training in that moment?
Mm. And are the needs of the training appropriate in that moment?
Yeah. I mean,
it's all about helping horses to become capable, maybe even athletic, without compromising their willingness or their emotional safety.
Mm-hmm.
And what you kind of alluded to is, if we have a problem with a horse who's just not feeling it, sometimes the solution lives outside of that direct interface you're in the middle of trying to solve right now. Sometimes, let's say you're asking a horse to trot and they're giving you every sign that they're about to not do that. Sometimes you solve that trot problem by not trotting and instead looking at, how is that horse living? What are they eating? Are they healthy? Are they sound? Are they socialized? You need to take care of those things first. And that's a long list, but it's a necessary list, because what other list is there for us to really appropriately consider? Because how many of us crawled out of the womb and the first time we had a coherent thought that could be committed to memory, it was a horse, whether we had ever met a horse before or not. We were just like horses. Yeah. And so why have we forgotten that? When we stand in front of an uncooperative horse and we stamp our foot and pout and moan about it. Now, I'm an Australian, so I've got a very particular allergy to people moaning about situations they've put themselves in. I've got a very particular allergy to it. I'm aware that I need grace and presence in that moment. I have an allergy to it because it's like, no, there's no time to complain. There's only time to consider, to reflect, and take action. There's only time for that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to feed a beast of complaining about the horses that we have bought and housed and proposed.
Yeah. No.
You know, things to. So we need to keep that in our mind and sort of scale back to scale forward sometimes. One of the best things I ever did for my horse's canter transitions was stop cantering him for 6 months, work on strengthening him in other gaits, and then put him back in a canter and discovered, oh, the canter's better now after 6 months of working on better walk and trot work.
Connor and I did that for a year way back in the day. I agree. That can absolutely be the best path forward. Right? We kind of have three separate entities to deal with, or three separate parts of that sort of puzzle of, you find yourself in front of a horse that nothing's happening that you weren't happening, or you don't feel forwards going. We've got the entity of their lifestyle and their care to look at. And then the training history, their idea, their preconceived notions around training and interacting with you. And then the human's technique, emotional, stability, or, ability to be balanced emotionally and present clear communication via a physical technique. So I think if I had to say, we've got those three main branches that we would need to address. And often when people are coming to this type of work, they come with the assumption that we won't speak to the part of the human sometimes needing to stand up and say, no, I would really like you to try, horse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is important to me that you move. I encounter that often, where people go, oh, I know you aren't going to want me to do this, but I want to ask my horse to trot now. Surprise. What? Surprise. I actually would love to see you do that, right? Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that we're considering all three of those areas and, giving them some weight.
Yes, because the problem is horses that haven't tried something don't know if that thing is better or not to do.
Right.
until they've tried it. And so having a robust relationship to try culture is, in my opinion, so much more helpful than having a robust relationship to hustle culture. Because hustle culture kind of spitballs and throws spaghetti at the wall over and over and over and over again. And at some point you're like, hang on, you never even stopped to see what sticks.
Right.
Right.
And conflates that with a healthy relationship to failure.
Yes. Right? Or productivity.
Mm-hmm. Because we need to be comfortable with failure. We need to be comfortable with that. It's a part of growth. It's a part of moving forward. But that doesn't give us license to just go like a bat out of hell without any consideration for that at the dust.
I don't think you and I have met a horse person who has it in their soul to go like a bat out of hell at a horse for a very long time. They just don't come into my field. And I'm grateful for that. And if they did, it would be like, feel, are you lost? You're right. How'd you get here? Fascinating how you got here. What wind blew you in here? You're going in a bat out of hell on that horse. Interesting. Okay, would you like my help? I don't know if you do. Would you like my help? I will offer it, but I need you to give very clear sign of consent to my help before I say anything. You know, but it's been such a long time since you and I met a horse person who has it in their soul to go at a horse like a bat out of hell. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that so many of our clients are so concerned about being the bat out of hell, it's like it's straw man concern. We are all concerned about something none of you have the capacities to do. So let it go. What's next? Mm-hmm. Ask your horse to try something. There, they tried it. Great. Good. Yeah. Rinse, repeat. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I love to bring up, where is your main... What's your most innate tendency going to be? Let's identify that. Okay, to be to wait. Then you know when you're finding yourself facing one of these questions from your horse, if you know your innate tendency is to wait, let's just play with what the other side of that is, because we know that we need have some room to grow there. Some room to explore.
What kind of person do you love teaching the most?
I mean... If my
you're like favorite, a kid in a candy store. You're I like all of them.
I love people, Lockie. It's my favorite. I'm looking up because I've got a list of my mentorship students up on my, you know, in each of my groups. I'm looking like that one and that one. I love teaching and working with people who are most invested in their horse's well-being and in growing that relationship, and that they're interested in diving into detail, but also that they want to get out there and practice in reality. Mm-hmm. You know, so people that are interested in their horse's experience and that want to get a little more information to become more empowered to do more on their own, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between people who want information and people who want transformation?
That's such a good way to put it. Like, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's helpful to be able to figure out who's in front of you in that regard. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I can enjoy working with either type of person. Absolutely. I just would like to know.
Because the person who's coming information forward needs to be aware that a transformation will occur when you get that information. And the person who's coming transformation forward needs to be aware that some information is going to be needed to assimilate it in order for that transformation to occur. So both of them are kind of have the tendency to be potentially myopic. Mm-hmm. And so broadening that lens is part of the work, I think.
Absolutely, because I do think there's a sector of the equine industry population that is stuck on information gathering as a skill.
Hoarding.
Yeah, right, consumerism.
As a
they're
skill.
They're consuming the information.
Yeah.
And that can easily become
method shopping.
Yeah, well, it's like I'm going to look for the next technique so that I, because that's, that feels easier. The technique might provide the change rather than the internal work to remove whatever emotional block might be preventing transformation.
Yes. And it's also another search for like a dopamine, a cheap dopamine hit that gives you the feeling that something's coming down the pipeline, but what's coming down the pipeline is the need for another dopamine hit. Mm-hmm. And it can sometimes, not always, sometimes be used as a smokescreen to cover up an avoidance of some deeper issues present in a horse, in a person, in their work that need to be addressed properly so that we can actually move forward now.
Yeah. It's a fun line.
It's a fun line. And speaking of that line, what we're really talking about is helping people have breakthroughs, which I feel very lucky to have witnessed so many. Very grateful to have witnessed so many, sometimes daily. But what we're not interested in doing is breaking people down to right. have that breakthrough. We've seen that happen in clinics in recent years. Some of my colleagues kind of trauma spotlight someone and suddenly someone who's come to a horse clinic to try and improve their riding confidence is standing crying in the middle of the arena talking about, you know, daddy trauma. And it's like, hang on a minute.
That's
not on.
Inappropriate. Completely inappropriate. Yeah.
Inappropriate. So, but in a smaller scale, in a less extreme way, this is my last question for you. How do you, no pressure, how do you help people have a breakthrough without breaking them down?
You know, I think one of the things that's most important is in having that instructor or coach relationship set up. Like, I mean, it's kind of hard because it can be so different, right? You can meet someone. I've had this happen where you meet someone at just the right point in their horsemanship journey arc that you offer this one little piece and
it's there.
Seed. Yeah. I mean, I've certainly seen that happen, but more commonly, I think it's gardening type of leadership, right? It's creating that fertile bed where I can sit there and help support by signposting some things and trying to set some parameters and boundaries around where we will and won't go, and offering information. But I think the biggest breakthrough type that I see is really people being able to step into their own power, to feel empowered, to notice things they never did before, which can unlock a greater breakthrough in their life or in feeling like they can take that step forward on their own, or that they come up against a challenge. And I think part of my role or our role as coaches in that moment is to be able to notice when that challenge can be bite-sized enough and not be overwhelming, and to be able to support kind of the hand-holding, walking through rocky ground. You know, some people really want you to help them balance. And some people need you to just be like, I'm here if you need. I'm over here. I'm ahead. I've noticed this is a slippery rock. You got it? Cool. So I think it's that line that any space holder is walking in trying to figure out where's enough, where's too much.
Michelle Knapp, did you just use the term space holder in a sentence?
Of course I did.
We have become so woke.
trying to reach everybody here, right?
Oh, I love it. I love it. Yes. Mm. Perfect. Great. I love it. Well, Michelle, I think that's enough. Speaking of bite-sized chunks, that's a big chunk for people to bite off and chew on today.
Indeed.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Anything else you want to say today?
I'll just go on about how, you know, I'm dripping with gratitude. And no, seriously though, it's the most professional satisfaction I've had in the equine industry, being part of this team and working with you and being able to be in this container and grow it and watch the transformations. I mean, it's my favorite. So thank you. And thanks for having me on again.
Thank you for being here. I couldn't do it without you now. And yeah, wow, she has the power is coming together. Yeah, so if anyone wants to book Michelle, you're available for discovery calls. You're available for live lessons with horses anywhere in the world and coaching calls where we review pre-recorded video from anywhere in the world. What? You can book those online. They're reasonably priced according to industry standards and according to your chops, frankly. They're reasonably priced and they're available to anyone anywhere in the world that's got an internet connection and a smartphone. So you can find Michelle there if you'd like to work with her. And yeah, thanks for being here. Talk to you soon, yeah?
Thanks, Lucky. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you would like to support this podcast, a simple way to do that is by leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. It will help more people to find these conversations, and it would mean a lot to me. Horse First with Lockie Phillips is distributed by the Believe Audio and Video Network. And just a gentle reminder, the content of this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and are not a substitute for professional, veterinary, or medical advice. I'm Lockie Phillips. Thank you for being here.